Talk about work that I've done with people at MIT, Krishna, Hom, another student, and Urs from CERN, as well as a paper with just Hom with the title the same as the title of the talk, and also some work in progress. So my outline is following. I'll start with a motivation. So why are we interested in studying these meson setups in holographic setups? Also, part of the motivation will be a discussion of sort of semi-classical strings and just the standard ADS CFT setup and its force with Yang-Mills. And then I'll start talking about a more realistic system where you actually have dynamical clocks in the system. Perhaps many people are familiar with the system. It's the D3D7. Setup. And I'll talk about some properties of mesons in this setup. In particular, we'll find that there's an interesting subluminal limiting velocity for these mesons. Then I'll also talk about sort of a puzzle in the system where the mesons, to all, you can argue that the mesons in a certain phase of the system have zero width, so all orders in some perturbative alpha prime expansion. So you need to go to non-perturbative effects to see the width. And then if I have time, I'll talk about the phase diagram of this system. And it's been studied before, but I'll revisit it for certain reasons. And then I'll conclude. So the motivation, as usual, is from QCD. So it turns out in QCD, there are heavy quark bound states, which in the plasma of QCD, the quark gluon plasma, survive above the deconfinement transition. So this is interesting. And nice at the same time. It's attributed to their small size compared to this deconfinement temperature TC. And as a result, because they survive, then they're good probes of the quark gluon plasma. So in particular, they're sensitive to medium effects. So if you study these bound states in this plasma, there are certain effects that you have to take into account, and that's a nice probe of the quark gluon plasma. So in particular, there's this color screening, which is basically screening of the color potential between the QQ bar pair. And at finite temperature, it's screened, sort of by screening. And as a result, as you increase the temperature, the temperature being already above the deconfinement transition, as you increase the temperature even further, then eventually the bound states will dissociate because of this screening effect. But there are also other effects, like there's collisions with the deconfined quarks and gluons, and they can also break apart the bound state. So this will induce a width. Yes?
Evidence for this existence?
Next slide. Okay, so the evidence for this is there's both lattice evidence as well as experimental evidence. So you can show on the lattice, you can calculate the heavy quark potential, and basically you see that the above the deconfinement temperature, the potential sort of levels off at some length scale. So that there is no interactions anymore between the QQ bar pair, and this is denoted the screening length, and it decreases as you increase the temperature. So eventually, as it decreases beyond the size of this bound state, then the QQ bar pair will no longer be bound. That's one way to look at it. Another way is just to go straight to the spectral functions of sort of Maison correlation functions, and you can actually observe that the peak, which you would associate with J psi, becomes much broader as you increase the temperature past this dissociation temperature. And the rough estimates for this is that the dissociation temperature for J psi at least is 1.5 to 2.5 Tc. I think they're done with both, and yeah, I think that this number definitely varies a lot. I mean, I've given a wide range for a reason. So also in heavy ion collisions, you expect this to result in some sort of suppression in the production of J psi, and it's suppression relative to what you would just normally expect if it was just a proton-proton collision instead of an ion-ion collision. Okay, so there are some theoretical challenges here. So in particular, a heavy quark meson produced in a heavy ion collision, the heavy ion collision is a very dynamical environment, and so you would expect that these mesons might have some large momentum relative to the plasma. And so it's interesting to ask how do all these medium effects change as you increase the velocity or momentum relative to the plasma. So in particular, it would be nice to characterize the screening length and the dissociation temperature for a moving meson. Yeah.
Does it produce in the plasma, or you know, at the later stage when you know there is a synchronization process?
It's very messy. I think some are at least produced in the very initial stages of the collision, but there's also potential recombination between Charmoni and CC bar pairs. It's a messy story.
Are people able to distinguish, say where it was? Can you test experimentally where it was produced? How do you distinguish something that was?
Yeah, I don't know. Moderate, I guess.
Yeah, it's not clear how it will be produced. Is it, but somehow, it's, as you said, it's more or less straightforward to think how they are produced during, during catheterization. But it's not clear to me why they will be produced at all in the plasma itself.
Okay.
And that's an important question because that's related to the last bullet point, how you are going to model it. Once you model it in ADAC, assuming that they are in the plasma rather than
late stages. So this might be one ingredient in a very complicated, messy story.
And how does your lifetime scale see?
The lifetime? With the temperature?
Yeah.
The lifetime will become very short as you go to the dissociation.
I suppose I'm below the dissociation temperature.
How does it scale like that? I don't know. The increase.
What is near the dissociation temperature?
Okay, so sorry, I'm just gonna seem to miss this. Okay. All right, so I'll start out. This is also part of the motivation of let's look at just standard semi-classical strings in ADS 5 SS 5. So as we know, this is dual to Sporcupian Mills theory. If you add a black hole, then the black hole then in the gauge theory, that's like temperature. Standard dictionary alpha prime, the string scale, there's like 1/√ lambda, and the string coupling was like 1 over C. So in this setup, there aren't any clocks, but you can study basically by the study in the lattice, you can study the heavy clock potential by looking at these semi-classical strings. If you consider the load sheet of the string from going from one point to the other, then the extremum of this will basically compute for you this heavy clock potential. And if you look at this as a function of the distance between the QQ bar K, as you increase the distance, eventually the string will want to fall into the black hole, preferentially over reconnecting like this, and that has the interpretation of the string. So you can, it's nice to begin with. You can also put these clocks at a certain velocity. You can do the same problem again, and you find that actually the screening length decreases as you increase the velocity in the following way. So this suggests that a meson with a higher velocity relative to the plasma will dissociate at a lower temperature. So for example, if you fix the temperature and you identify the dissociation as the scale and the screening length becomes the order of the meson size, which is some energy scale minus one, then at fixed temperature, as you increase the velocity, then you might expect that the mesons will dissociate, and there'll be some sort of maximum velocity beyond which they don't exist, or you might say there's some maximum momentum. And we'll see evidence for both of these things. Okay. So now I'm going to talk about a more physical setup where we actually have dynamical clocks in our ADS-D setup. So I'll be looking at the D3D7 system. And here's a picture of that. So we have our ADS-5 space, which I drew before. This is the boundary here, and this is the horizon, the black hole horizon. And basically, to add a quark, add a dynamical quark into the system, you want to add deep rings. You want to add open strings. So the best way to do this is to add a D7 ring. And what you find by basically looking at the DBI action and extremizing it for the curve for the embedding of this D7 ring, you find that the D7 ring sort of fills all of ADS5 up to some minimum radius. This minimum radius has some sort of interpretation. So as a clock mass, which I'll talk about later, next. But also I've drawn here the embedding in the S5. So here I have the radius again, R. R is the radius in this direction, and here is sort of the S5. So think of the R times S5 as some sort of R6, six-dimensional thing. And basically, the D7 brain sort of wraps an S3 in this S5, and then as you decrease the radius towards this minimum radius, the S3 shrinks too. And this is the embedding function R of theta, and that's found by this sort of extremizing this DBI action. Okay. Does everyone understand this stuff? The dictionary is as follows. So temperature is equivalent to a black hole, where the temperature scales like the radius of this black hole, which is R0 here. The mesons, let me first say that a quark is essentially a string with one endpoint on the D7 ring, and then another endpoint somewhere else. We know there's a horizon here, so let's put it there. If you take a string and a Q bar pair, and you bring them close enough together, they want to join. So a meson, which is this QQ bar pair, is a string which goes from the D7 brain to the D7 brain. And of course, we know that that is equivalent to sort of the modes on the D7 brain, the modes of oscillation. So the meson is a fluctuation of the D7 brain, and you can show that the mass scales like something like this, which is also proportional to this Rm here. And the quark mass scale, you can argue, is this distance from here to here. So this is some sort of thermally corrected fast mass. If you didn't have a black hole here, the embedding in this picture would be flat. And this distance here asymptotically is related to the bare quark mass. So this distance is the bare quark mass. This distance is some sort of thermally corrected quark mass.
So if you define thermally corrected mass, like you said there, right? Yes. So if you raise the temperature too high, what will happen is that the D7 will begin to surprise you.
I'll talk about that.
Right, but what is a bit counterintuitive with your definition of a quark mass? Why does the thermal quark mass will go to zero in that case? So then the string will just extend from the tip up to the horizon to zero distance.
Yeah, so there won't be really a quark.
Right, but maybe we would expect that what finite temperature is doing actually keeps your mass high, at least, you know, in the perturbative.
Sure, it's a bit strange that here the thermally corrected process is decreased. I don't know what to say about that.
Sorry, so in the absence of black hole, the bare quark mass is infinite, right?
What? I mean, it's just a parameter. This is just the parameter in the direction.
Okay.
It's fine.
But we're in the confining phase and outside of the open loop.
In the confining phase? So
it's just a black hole.
It's not really a confined phase. The potential between Q bar is like one over R, so it's not confined. So I should say, I should have specified this. In the NS4 super Yang-Mills theory, there is no deconfinement-confinement transition. We're always in the deconfined phase. Also, if you like, at zero temperature, you can take a string from this flat D brain and end it on the AES horizon. So this L is related to the bare quark mass. Oh, sorry, this is what I forgot to say. But if you look at these scales, the meson mass scale and the quark mass scale, you note that they're related as follows to the Ekluft coupling. So in particular, in the large lambda limit, these mesons are very light compared to the quark. So the quark is very heavy. So that tells us that these meson bound states are very deeply bound. Their binding energy is approximately twice the quark. Okay, so now if you increase the temperature of the black hole, then eventually the D7 brain will fall in. That's equivalent to decreasing the bare quark mass as follows. So that's sort of what I've drawn here. And this is interpreted as this dissociation transition, because basically the meson spectrum on here is discrete. The reason for that is that, I'll discuss this later, but it's because the geometry on the D7 brain doesn't know anything about the black hole, and it's sort of smoothly capped off this scale. But over here, as the D7 brain falls into the black hole, then suddenly there's sort of an induced horizon on the D7 brain, and these mesons suddenly see this horizon, and the spectrum becomes continuous. Yes.
Just about this quark mass. So at zero temperature, as you know, a bare quark mass is a free parameter.
Yes.
Because I can pretty much put the D7 brain anywhere I want.
Yes.
But here, what you have is a bare.
This is the bare quark mass. So you can tune this.
What's that? Is that to, I mean, are you computing that to the what, to the origin of, I mean, if there is a black hole, is the distance L inside, up to inside of the black hole?
It's this asymptotic distance here in this diagram. I mean, it's related to how this this embedding function that goes to the AGS boundary. So that's still just a parameter that you can choose.
So there is one of the coordinates along, you're saying there is still one of the coordinates along the wall volume of the D7.
Yes.
If I go along that direction, zero temperature embedding asymptotic.
Yes, that's right. Exactly. Yes.
So I worried a little bit that you are losing that parameter, but
no,
I still have it. Yeah.
So, let's look at the meson spectrum. So we'll just look at it's a D7 brain, so there's 8 dimensions, there's 2 transverse scalar fields to the which represents transverse fluctuations to the D brain. There's some radial mode and an angular mode. You can write these fluctuations in a nice geometric way, in some sort of orthonormal basis, and then the extremum of the DBI action corresponds to basically setting the extrinsic curvatures in these directions to zero, and then your fluctuations, your action via fluctuations is quadratic, with the masses given by sort of curvature invariants along the seven brain.
Why there is only one dimension three operator? Why you don't have dimension two operator? I mean, you would expect that because the model is supersymmetric, you know, everything comes in a supersymmetric multiple. So
sure.
So what happens with dimension? Where is dimension two operator?
So you mean a dimension two operator like phi bar, where that's the scalar field? That's actually in this multiple. It just appears with an extra mass in front of it. I don't know. So the meson spectrum is basically solving the problem of finding the meson spectrum is just solving some Klein-Gordon equation, and then you can Fourier decompose on the S3. You can put in spherical harmonics, and then you just get some differential operator here acting on psi, and the spectrum is found by demanding that this wave function at the tip is smooth, and that at infinity it vanishes, and this will give you a discrete spectrum. Basically, because it's like solving a quantum mechanics problem in an infinite box. If you look at the momentum dependence, as you increase the momentum, you find that the dispersion relation goes to some limiting group velocity, and this has sort of the general picture as follows. If you look at the wave function, as you increase the momentum, it becomes more and more peaked. The reason for this is basically you're putting more and more energy into these mesons, and they're being pulled more towards the black hole. And as the wave function increases, it becomes localized at this tip. And if you look at the metric at this tip, you have some sort of local speed of light, which is smaller than one, from the redshift factor of the black hole. So this is some general argument why you would have a limiting velocity, which is less than one in these systems. So you can characterize this limiting velocity at large momentum. And if we look at it as a function of temperature, then it decreases towards zero as you increase the temperature towards the dissociation. This is also a picture of the group velocity. This is increasing the temperature towards dissociation, going down. And you find this interesting peak here. So the maximum velocity is actually a little higher than the limiting velocity. Okay, so now onto the width of these mesons. So as I've sort of emphasized a few times, that in the embedding where the D7 brain lies outside the horizon, it's also commonly called the Minkowski embedding, these mesons have zero width. There's a discrete spectrum. So this is a puzzle. Why? Because for temperatures below the dissociation temperature, this is when we have the embeddings apply at outside the black hole. As I said, there's a zero width. This is a puzzle because if you recall, this is a deconfined plasma. There are gluons and quarks that are running around. And there's no reason why they can't run into this meson and break it apart. From the string theory side, basically, because of the topology of the D7 brain, because it lies outside of the black hole, and if you look at the geometry on the D7 brain, it's some sort of smoothly capped off, asymptotically ADS, capped off at some radius Rm. And this in ADS CFT is usually associated with confinement. Confinement means zero width when NC goes to infinity. So you might try and relax the alpha prime goes to zero limit, and you have some sort of derivative expansion on the D brain. This won't change this conclusion as long as this D brain is, the distance between the D brain and the black hole is much bigger than the string length. Then in the perturbative alpha prime expansion, there should be still be a zero width for these mesons. And as I said, at finite temperature in a deconfined plasma, these bound states should have a non-zero width. So this implies some, maybe, there's obviously G string corrections, which are 1 over NC corrections. And then maybe there's some non-perturbative alpha prime correction. So there's another puzzle in this system, and that's to do with chemical potential, baryon or quark chemical potential. So you can turn on a chemical potential in the system by looking at the gauge field that lives on the D7 brain, and this couples to the boundary theory as follows. If you look at asymptotically at large radius, then the time component of the gauge field, if you turn that on to some non-zero value, that's equivalent to turning on a chemical potential in your gauge theory. And as usual, the expectation value of the associated operator for that, which is the density operator, the number density sits here in this expansion. So you might demand that this gauge field goes to mu, and then solve for the gauge field and calculate the number density from that. But in the Minkowski phase, you can turn on a gauge field, and it's still a chemical potential, and it's still a solution, where AT of R is just mu for all of R. So there's no radial dependence. That means there's no quark density. So you've turned on a chemical potential, and you have no quark density. This is sort of a puzzle at non-zero temperature. where you might expect some sort of thermal excitation. But there is no horizon, that's the point. So when the embedding lies outside the black hole, you can do it. When it falls in, you can no longer do this. So sort of in the phase where it falls in, this isn't a puzzle. So
once you turn on this chemical potential, is this spectrum being affected? Is there an effect of chemical potential on the spectrum of metals?
No.
Well, how do you know that that's not a pure gauge? I mean, just again, I understand but in principle, you know, there is still a gauge freedom associated with the bulk vector field, and I guess.
Sure. I think you might have to restrict the gauge transformations, which don't change this at the boundary. I mean, this is some asymptotic value for the AT.
Right. But isn't that puzzling that you're turning on a chemical potential, and well, of course, the reason why it doesn't amp is because in all your DBI actions, the only things that amp are field strengths.
That's right.
Here you just have. Isn't that surprising?
I mean, that's sort of part of the puzzle. I'll try to resolve. So this is also true in a perturbative alpha prime expansion because the correction to the DBI action are just functions of field strengths, and as you said, that doesn't know about this constant mu. And I should also say that as you tune the chemical potential too high, there's a new phase, thermodynamically new phase where the B7 brain falls into the horizon, and this is thermodynamically preferred. So I'll discuss that later. So from the field theory side, you expect thermal contributions from quarks. But if you remember, the quark mass is much larger than the meson mass by root lambda. So if we look at some beta and q, beta is one of the temperature, and it goes like root lambda times the meson mass of the temperature. So as long as as we're looking at a regime where the temperature is not too high, which is what we are, we're looking at temperatures less than the dissociation temperature, this is a very large number. So in particular, these sort of thermal densities that you might expect, which go like this Boltzmann factor here, are exponentially smaller than the Wittolf number. Similarly, the binding energy is very large for these mesons, it's twice the mass of the quark. So thermal fluctuations, which will tear the quark apart, will also be Boltzmann suppressed and exponentially suppressed. So this won't be visible in the perturbative one over root lambda. But maybe it'll have normative origins on the world sheet. And of course, there's 1 over nc corrections. There's just sort of standard 1 over nc, which you might expect. This is a QQ bar pair, it can annihilate. So that'll give it a width. And then there's sort of these meson interactions. There's also thermal corrections at 1 over nc squared, which contribute to the width that don't actually break the meson apart. And this is worked by these people. There is some sort of non-perturbative correction. If we look at the geometry in Euclidean time, then there's some sort of non-trivial cycle with boundary, but it's wrapping this Euclidean time. So let me explain the geometry here. So we have the standard picture that I talked about before, which is the S5. If we look at just the Euclidean time, then thermal gauge theory, Euclidean time is identified with tau goes to tau plus beta. And in the string theory side, this is equivalent to a black hole, but we know that the Euclidean geometry of a black hole basically this identification is smoothed off at the horizon at some sort of disk. So the topology of the Euclidean black hole is a disk, where this is the boundary, this is the radius, and this is the boundary. And as I said before, the seven brain only fills a part of the ADS space. It fills it to some radius Rn. So there's still this sort of unfilled disk here, and this is where the cycles of boundary sit. So you can map the string world sheet, the open string world sheet, into this, obeying the boundary conditions and the equations of motion. So how would this contribute to the width? Well, essentially now we've changed the topology of this D7 ring. We've allowed these mesons to connect to the horizon through this string. So you can sort of think of these fluctuations as maybe being able to leak through the string. I should also say to avoid confusion that this is really just a thermal clock. This is just a thermal clock, because if you look at it before, previously I had this picture of a clock being from going from the D brain to the horizon. Mm-hmm. That's all that this world sheet does. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how does this solve our problems? Well, let's do some string theory. So you might try to calculate the string partition function, which is basically an integral over maps from this disk to the space time. So the x here is the world sheet field, the embedding of this disk, and this is sort of what. This is an action you might choose. You might be more advanced and choose the polyfill action. And then there's some sort of boundary interaction between some background fields, which are these D7 brain fluctuation fields. These the gauge fields as well as the scale fields that I talked about. So this is some coupling between the world sheet fields and D7 rank fields. And then what you can do is you can sort of argue that you can compute this partition function in some sort of saddle point approximation in various topological sectors for these winding lines. So I didn't say before, but this can actually map winding n times into this geometry. Now, an interesting fact about string theory is that if you take this map and if you look at these this embedding of the string and you map it to this zero topological sector, i.e. you're mapping all the fields to a single point, then that actually computes for you the space-time action. So that actually gives you the DGI action. So the effective action becomes sort of some sort of sum over these saddle points. The zero order sector gives you the DBI action back again, and then you get higher order contributions from these other sectors. And interestingly enough, if you compute just the action of this world sheet, then it goes like beta m cubed plus or minus mu beta, and these space-time actions are going to be e to the minus, they're going to go like e to the minus I here. So they're going to give us exactly this thermalism breaks. The plus or minus here is for whether the world sheet is winding one way or the other.
So one is suppressed, the other one is
enhanced. No, they're both suppressed by this factor. When you tune the chemical potential maybe above this factor, then one is enhanced and the other is. But they're both. Okay, so if we just turn off these background fields, then we can compute the free energy of this configuration. think free energy is related to the Euclidean action through this, and then we have this extra contribution to the free energy, which is above the DBI action, which looks something like this. So these are these Boltzmann factors here. The plus or minus is for a quark or anti-quark. G string to the minus one is because it's a disk. This is nice because that means that these free energies are going to scale like NC. Up here, from the free energy, we can derive the number density just by taking derivatives with respect to the chemical potential. And we find the number density is now non-zero, which is nice. So if we turn on a chemical potential, we get non-zero number densities. They're exponentially suppressed, but they're also proportional to NC. So there's NC quark, so that's nice.
Sorry, but you don't see that as a normalizable mode of the whatever instanton corrected gauge potential.
You don't see the normal. Yeah, so I think these can source that. These strings will actually source the gauge field. I mean, they have charge and they source the gauge field. So at infinity, that will be a non-zero, non-normalizable mode. And that should be the same as this.
But you haven't checked.
We haven't done that calculation, but it should be. That's a good point. The free energy here is proportional to the V3, which is the volume in the three spatial dimensions. And this is just coming from the three bosonic gluon modes. This should be compared to the DBI action, which came from this topologically trivial sector. This has 8 bosonic zero modes, and that just corresponds to the integral over your 8 dimensions for the DBI action. There are no fermionic zero modes because this is a thermal disk. How might you calculate the width? Basically, the idea is to take this DBI action that we were working with before and then add to it this new action which accounts for these instantons, but include now a background. If we expand these terms to quadratic order in these background fields, then we get the following action. Where G, this propagator here is basically a boundary-to-boundary propagator on the Lord sheet disk. So by boundary here, I mean the boundary of the Lord sheet, not the boundary of the radius. So you can take this, you can compute meson correlators in the Euclidean using the standard ADS-CFT dictionary, and then analytically continue back to real times, and you basically find that the poles have been shifted by a smaller imaginary part. Alternatively, you can compute this directly in real times by continuing this basically the world sheet disk, the time on the world sheet disk to real times, and then you're basically studying fluctuations of this disk in realist space time. And the prescription is to take basically the equation of motion that you get from the Euclidean and then replace this Euclidean propagator here with the retarded propagator in real time. And this is basically what it looks like. This delta function here means that the string is supported at this tip. It wasn't very clear, but this beta is never explained that, but beta is zero, it corresponds to the tip of the D7 brain. Okay. And then you can do what we did before, Fourier transpose these meson fields, and basically now you're solving a problem with a delta function correction to the potential. So you can easily solve this using perturbation theory, and you find the width that looks like this. This width is of order one. There's NC, there's
the number density here is proportional to NC, so this is 4 to 1. Because this potential is only supported at the origin, this width is actually going to be proportional to the wave function of these of this given mode at the origin. So this is a very simple result.
Are there some factors of lambda hidden in MQ, or does the width go like square root of lambda?
Yeah, it depends how you write it. If you were to write it in terms of the Meson mesh, then you would get some extra lambdas downstairs. But this lambda is an interesting scale. What to make of that?
But shouldn't I have expected the width to be a small correction, but lambda is large?
These number densities are exponentially small. Sorry.
Oh,
right. So I've hidden all the thermal factors in these number densities. I didn't explain that at all. In a sense, there's this big whopping factor that we have not calculated, which is this determinant. It's really hard, horrible to calculate. But we've sort of hidden that by saying, well, that's proportional to the number density, so we can rewrite it like this. But also, this gives you a nice interpretation of this width, which is basically coming from this process. So I'll just talk about the field theory first. Basically, you have a thermal clock coming in, and basically annihilating this meson as follows. So this is the meson QQ bar, and the quark comes in and annihilates it, and the quark goes out. So this clearly, this process is clearly going to be proportional to the number density of the quarks here. There's also another sort of more interesting diagram that we are not computing, which is something like this. If you have a meson, then the gluon can come in and sort of annihilate this meson, and the QQ bar pair will come out. This is going to be proportional to the binding energy. This is something that I alluded to before. So e to the minus beta times the binding energy. And this is sort of twice the quark mass. So this is going to be further suppressed. And it will correspond to, in this language, some sort of instanton, anti-instanton correction. But in QCD, this is clearly a much more interesting thing to calculate. So in QCD, this process, if you think about it, if you have a J psi, it's a charm quark fluctuating, a thermal charm quark fluctuating, that's basically never going to happen. But this would be much more interesting for QCD, because the binding energy is not very large. From a string theory perspective, basically the interpretation is we have some open string mode within a deep brain, and it can tunnel into the black hole.
What happens to multi-gluon processes? I mean, so.
Well, you mean this?
Yeah.
This is very schematic. This is a strongly coupled theory. There's probably a bunch of stuff coming up here. The width that we've calculated is proportional to this wave function at the origin. We haven't actually calculated these number densities as a function of temperature and chemical potential because of this functional determinants messy thing that I haven't tried to calculate. But we can look at the momentum dependence of this width, because all of the momentum dependence lies in this wave function. As I said before, the wave functions that you find as you increase the momentum become more and more localized at the tip. So that tells you that the wave function does depend on momentum, but it also tells you that this width is going to increase as you increase the momentum. In fact, you can show analytically that it increases like k squared. And for small temperatures, you get an expression something like this. And so there's a nice general argument for why this is. Again. So if you calculate this, basically you calculate this wave function at the origin, then you can calculate this ratio. And at zero temperature, it's just flat. As you increase the temperature, it starts to peak at momentum closer and closer to the mass of the meson. And basically, the point at which this curve starts to increase is the same as the point where the meson group velocity reached its maximum. So if you remember, the velocity had this weird maximum, and then it goes to its limiting velocity. And this scaling is consistent with what we found from the semi-classical analysis.
But again, you know, you are not writing here this it is a minus lambda suppression. So.
Yeah, so we're hitting that gamma zero, but if you maybe you can argue this scaling also applies to QCD. In particular, you might argue that it applies to the gluon break apart process that I.
Well, I guess it's not clear to me that I mean, this is in some sense this is a scaling of a prefactor, but why what did you expect that there will be a k dependence in the you know in this n plus minus kind of compute?
Oh, there is not.
How do you
remember? N plus or minus is essentially determined by this functional determinant, which doesn't know anything about the meson wave function, or the meson limits. It's just completely localized on the string. It's fluctuations of the string. So it doesn't depend.
Even when the string is moving, right? So somehow
the string isn't really ever moving because it's so massive, so very massive. So maybe you want to move it, and then it'll change.
But isn't k the how should I think of k?
Oh, sorry, k is the momentum of the meson.
Right. So k is momentum of the meson, and I guess maybe you want to say that this n plus minus also could be equilibrium.
That's right. Yeah. So there's sort of this meson moving through this thermal bath of quarks, and sometimes it gets destroyed by one of these quarks. But this background number density doesn't change as you increase the momentum.
I think, I'm sorry, this is just a stupid physics question. So if I have an equilibrium number density and then I have a moving observer, would the number density stay the same? Presumably it will change.
But the formula that I've written here would apply to the number density at zero momentum. So there will also be all sorts of gamma factors, but they're actually this is all of the momentum dependence.
But the reason why I'm worried because you know any k dependence that would happen, you know, just sort of moving from a static observer to a moving observer, which is what your meson is, just because that thing has a huge enhancement, right, enhancement or suppression due to the square root of lambda, that can change completely your scaling and the.
Yeah, I agree, but I think the number density that I'm specifying here is the number density in the rest mass.
Oh, I understand this. Yeah. If you look at the sort of relative weights depending on n, right?
Yes.
So then I agree with the formula.
Oh, I see.
So my question is about the absolute.
Oh.
Because in those cases, I agree that will sort of cancel out, right? It can receive k dependent correction, but will cancel out. But this absolute scaling for the weights, right? So
this is certainly only the only k dependence. Maybe you can. So let me go back. So this formula, this is true. This number density here is the number density at zero momentum.
Right.
So it does. It's not being redshifted. It's not changing with a gamma factor. You might say, well, this isn't very relativistic, so let's put in, you know, some JU, VU term, right? And then you would have to correct for that by also introducing a gamma factor. So that would then come into here, and then this would be proportional to the local number density, and there would be some correction to this. But as this stands, this is the only momentum dependence lies in here.
Mm-hmm.
So that's certainly true. So you might say, well, relative to what you would expect from sort of relativistic boosting arguments, this momentum dependence, this is certainly the absolute momentum scale. That's for sure. It's not the absolute width, but it's the absolute momentum scale. Okay. So now we have time. Let's compare it to this phase where you increase the chemical potential above the clock, the thermoelectric clock mass. So basically, what happens here is that the P7 ring now wants to fall into the black hole, and it does so in a very narrow neck. And this neck looks very much like a bundle of strings. So you might say maybe there's some sort of relation between what we've been talking about and this phase. One thing to note about this comparison is that the width of this neck grows like the number density, the square root of the number density. So for very small number density, this width is going to be very small. And that actually means that the curvature here is going to be very, very large. So in particular, you might not trust this calculation for very small densities beyond the scale, but for small enough densities, for small enough width, then maybe these strings, these instantons, are a better description. So there's sort of two different descriptions you can argue. And then there's some work by Rob Myers and Melinda, where they looked at this phase, and they looked at this meson spectrum. It's now continuous, and if you look at small densities, then you can actually see in the spectral functions for these mesons very localized peaks, and you can extract the width, and in particular they extract the momentum dependence of the width, and this compares the two in this phase from this instanton calculation, and in this phase here. So they look roughly similar, which is interesting. I don't think I have much time to talk about this, but this is a work in progress. Continuing on from what I was just talking about there, where in this phase where mu is bigger than the thermal clock mass, this D7 brain falls into the horizon in a very narrow neck. You can sort of make this limit more precise by studying the NQ goes to zero limit of these embeddings. Unfortunately, the sort of the perturbation theory is singular, and this limit is not uniform. So you have to sort of split this limit into various regions. You can do that. The inner region basically it is found by scaling out the number density by the width that I said, which goes like the square root of the number density, and then just looking at the outer region here. And if you look at the exact embeddings, which are given here in a Y row plot, so this is related to the pictures that I've been showing before, where theta is basically the angle between y and rho. But now I've drawn this on a log growth plot, so you can really see this narrow neck appearing. These are very, very small densities, and the embedding looks something like this. For very small densities, you get this nice scaling
where this, the form of this here, of this function, is the same if you just shift it in this log plot. So this is suggesting this region, this splitting into region. So I should say this is the actual embedding. It goes up like this. And then this line here is this function here, the perturbative inner solution. And this dashed line here is the perturbative outer solution. So you've got to sort of do perturbation theory in these two regions and match. And actually, one interesting thing that I just did very recently is if you can calculate the exact width in this n goes to zero limit by studying the fluctuations in these two different regions that you've scaled out, and actually you find out the exact same result as the instant one calculation, which is interesting. You can also use these scalings to study the phase diagram in more detailed analysis. It's more density. I will spare you the details. But at the end of the day, we have the following picture for the phase diagram. So this is temperature and this is chemical potential. This dashed line here, if you think of this is the y-axis, this is the x-axis. This function here, mq, is mq of t. So this is this thermally corrected quark mass that goes towards zero as the temperature goes towards the dissociation temperature. Using this split into inner and outer region, you can actually show that the transition across this line is a third-order phase transition, which is interesting. And it connects to some critical point here where the phase transition becomes second order, and then this line is first order. And this point here is also second order. And then we speculate that this is the phase diagram at lambda is infinite. At lambda very large, we kind of speculate that these thermal quarks, or these instantons, will actually smooth out this phase transition. Okay, so my conclusions. I've studied some dynamical properties of mesons in ADS-CFD. Looked at the limiting velocity at high momentum. Found a width via non-perturbative correction. The width grows like k squared. There's an open question as to do these features apply to QCD. Perhaps the best way to attack that is to look at the gluon contribution to the breakup, which is this process which is suppressed by the binding energy. And the question is, does this also grow with k? And you might speculate that this process is also determined or proportional to this wave function at the origin. And so because the wave function grows, you might speculate that this also grows. And then I've also discussed a little bit the nature of this phase diagram, in particular the phase transition as you tune this chemical potential. Okay, thank you.
How would you interpret the proportionality constant in your relation gamma proportional? So this is absolute value. Absolute gamma proportional to k squared.
Sorry, the this k squared for this.
Yeah.
So if you sort of turn this around and say, let's say we have some finite width, not some non-perturbatively small width for gamma zero, then you can figure out a momentum at which this width becomes of order one relative to, say, the mass scale. So it becomes of order the mass scale. And then you find a scaling for this k. And actually, it's exactly the same scaling as you found in your paper. So this. But this is small, so that's hand waving.
Good question. I think this figure again.